Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. This is the fourth part in our series, Thinking About Thinking. In the last episode, episode 3, Pete was talking about the uses of unreason, having previously talked in episode 2 about reason and the different types of reason, and in the first episode, how we celebrate thought and its uses and pleasures. But we decided that parts 3 and 4 were really one podcast because this is based on a series of notes that Pete made for a lecture he delivered at Wolverhampton University a few years ago. And we decided it was too long, really, to do in one podcast. So we're splitting it into two. So probably, possibly, if you only listen to this one, it will make sense, but it would probably be a good idea to listen to episode 3, as this is really, they really do go together. So, the uses of unreason. So Pete's just going to start where he left off at the end of episode 3, and I think he was going to start talking about silence. Is that right?
Yes.
Pete's just fiddling with his notes there.
Yeah.
I think he can remember where he got to.
But just to recap, what I've done so far in the previous episode, I hope, is to give a rough outline of Zen and a rough outline of unreason, to situate both of these in their context. And in this one, I want to just focus a little bit more on Zen Mondo. And move on from that consideration to elucidating the actual uses for life of unreason. Now, if you recall at the end of the last episode, I spoke about the submerged logic of Zen riddling, of the irrational sounding nature of Zen, and we caught a glimpse of that with when I recounted the conversation between Bodhidharma and Huike. If you recall, Huike chopped his arm off in order to focus the attentions of the master, of Bodhidharma, onto Huike's existential crisis. It was a crisis so intense that he thought that he'd got to chop his arm off to get this nutcase Bodhidharma to take notice of him. And of course, but Bodhidharma did, you know, in the conversation that ensued. It does sound like really, really absolutely crazy, you know. And, just to recap, Bodhidharma said, "Well, what do you want then?" And Huike says, "Master, pacify my mind. I cannot pacify my mind. Will you please pacify my mind? I am desperate. I am so desperate I've chopped my arm off." Bodhidharma says, "Well, I'll pacify your mind if you bring it to me. Just bring me your mind and I will pacify it." Huike says, "Master, I cannot find my mind to bring it." And Bodhidharma says, "Well, then I've pacified your mind." And you know, it's kind of crazy stuff. There's a bloke there standing with a bleeding stump, you know, and this crazy conversation. Now, I'm saying that actually does have a kind of a logic to it. And it's the logic of Nagarjuna that's behind that. And as I mentioned, Nagarjuna was anti-essentialist. And also was against bivalence. He didn't use the bivalence of our common sense logic, which says that we've got these two values, these two logical values, true and false, or X and not X. But Nagarjuna is wanting to turn around and say both X and not X. And it's this kind of logic that gave rise to some of the paradoxical utterances of the Buddha, for instance, form is void and void is form. And Nagarjuna came out with a similarly paradoxical statement, which is the culmination of his analysis of the human situation, in which he said, "Well, Nirvana is samsara, and samsara is Nirvana." Anyway, in other words, enlightenment is actually exactly the same thing as ordinary existence with all its sufferings and idiocies. Very, very paradoxical thing to say, because everybody else up to that point has tried to concede a nirvana as being totally other from ordinary life. And this is the transcendental attitude of Indian spirituality and Christian spirituality, for that matter. You know, that we seek elsewhere, we seek above, we attempt to go above, we rise beyond and above to transcend this ordinariness. Nagarjuna says not so, and it's kind of counterintuitive, because he's prepared to say both X and not X. The nirvana and samsara is precisely that, both X and not X. And it's this logic that informs Mondo. And in the case of Bodhidharma saying, well, bring me your mind, well, Hui Kai couldn't bring his mind, because his mind isn't a thing. His mind has no essence. His mind doesn't, there is no self for his mind to belong to. Your mind, as a phrase, makes no sense, because it attributes belonging of mind to an entity, to a self. But because everything's impermanent and everything's empty and everything depends on everything else, there is no self, there is not self. Self is empty of essence. This is why Hui Kai couldn't bring his mind to Bodhidharma. This is why he couldn't find his mind, because his mind isn't there to find, and there is nobody there to find it. So Bodhidharma's question is actually, on this logic, on this non-bivalent logic, totally rational and not unreasonable at all. You know, it just sounded kind of unreasonable. But nevertheless, it's definitely a world away from our common sense logic, and I suppose we are then, on that basis, justified in calling it unreason, because it's certainly not ordinary reason. But at the same time, it's not pure, capricious, fascist irrationality either. So silence. Well, form is void and void is form. Void, actually. Silence and void are the same. Meditative silence is always present. If you meditate, always. Because there could be no monkey mind without silence. There could be no thoughts without silence. There could be no stupidity without silence. There could be no wisdom without silence. So silence is the ground, you know. And with our non-bivalent logic, of course, we can say, well, silence is thought, and thought is silence. And on this take, we don't find this stark opposite between what appears to be unreason and what appears to be rationality. We don't find this stark opposition between critical appraisal, rationality, thinking of any sort on the one hand, and meditative silence and quiescence and samadhi on the other hand. They're not separate. They're only separate according to an essentialist and bivalent world picture. And if you do meditate, if you do enter into the existential despair that we can't enter into, you'll find that this distinction doesn't hold. So, Hui Kai, Master, pacify my mind. Bodhidharma, bring me your mind. Hui Kai, I cannot find my mind. Bodhidharma, then I have pacified your mind. In other words, by pacified there, Bodhidharma means I have exposed the nature of your mind as not a thing, as not belonging to anyone. There is no self for it to belong to. And mind is not a thing, but a series of events and processes in a network or a web of other events and processes, all interrelated in the independent origination. So it's a completely different world picture. In fact, that was Buddha's vision. In fact, that is the vision that comes from the perspective of silence. That is what you see. If you allow your mind to settle down, I'm not talking about forcing the mind to be quiet or cultivating any quiet in mind, it's just allowing the mind to settle, and all this stuff becomes apparent. The world and self do appear to us as impermanent, empty, as events in series of events enmeshed with other series of events and processes in a network of relationships, and none of it having any kind of a self or essence. And you can come to that silence by allowing the mind to settle. You can come to it by thinking also, by thinking as far as you can, by taking it to the limit, even though we don't know what the limit is, to get to just go to extremes with it, in the manner that Nagarjuna did. And that's just kind of a different approach from sitting, from doing Zazen, but nevertheless it comes to the same thing. And it's interesting that Wittgenstein, who I really like to compare with Nagarjuna, even though they're coming from completely different contexts with different sets of problems and so forth, there is a resemblance. And that's why I'm going to just read you this excerpt from Wittgenstein's Philosophical Investigations. It's number 133 if anybody's interested. The real discovery is the one that makes me capable of stopping doing philosophy when I want to. The one that is no longer tormented by questions which bring itself in question. So, Wittgenstein there has pacified his mind in precisely the same way that Bodhidharma, or Huike, pacified his own mind with a little bit of help from Bodhidharma. And Zen is really, is at its best, it's right at the heart of this network of existential possibilities. Nevertheless, Zen does have its methods. It's been around a long time now, and it's developed methods. And the methods, I suppose, these are the ones that are occurring to me at the moment. There's Zazen, sitting, in which you just sit. And that practice of sitting, if you can hack it, at some point it can be sooner, it can be later, it might be straight away, it might take decades, and you don't have to worry about that. But it will encourage the mind to settle. The mind will settle if you let it. And you will encounter the silence and realise that the silence is identical with the noise, or at least codependent on the noise. Yeah. The mind will pacify it for itself. There might be a fair bit of existential despair on the way, because you're bound to try to force it, which is what must have been what happened to Huike. I mean, chopping his arm off was trying to force it. You know.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, or even imagining that Bodhidharma had a magical cure, but of course he didn't. What he did was just to ask the right question. So of course, this is what Socrates would have done. He asked the right question.
Which, as we know, can be incredibly useful.
Yeah, asking the right question. I mean, and as a teacher there, you think, well, God, this first bloke, 15 years listening to the ant screen, and there he is, like a grandmother, he just asked the right question, did nothing, no magic. But what he did was expose the question, really. Expose how the question is like embedded in presuppositions and unquestioned presuppositions around biviolence and around essence and around stasis rather than process and around self rather than no self, not self. Around a universe of things as opposed to a universe of processes and events and relationships. Complete gestalt switch in one microsecond and the guy's enlightened. Probably off his face on endorphins, as you mentioned, because he's kind of bleeding out the stump of his arm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, when an existential despair like that is resolved, it is pretty exhilarating. And this guy, kind of this Uruk-hai, his existential spell was of a very great intensity, obviously. But you will probably encounter that if you try Zazen. You may not. But it's kind of quite likely that you'll do the fundamental thing there of trying to force the mind to stop, because somebody's told you when the mind goes quiet, it's really, really great. And you feel really, really at home in the universe. And nothing stands in your way, you're at peace, it's great. Of course, we'll want some of that. And of course, that wanting doesn't enable that initial silence to appear, to emerge. And the whole thing then spirals into a gnashing of the teeth, you know. So, and some people experience it like that. Another Zen method is the koan. I mean, different Zen schools emphasise different aspects of this. I mean, Zazen's emphasised in Soto Zen in the modern Japanese types of Zen. The Soto Zen is just big on sitting, just sitting, lots and lots of it, 20 hours a day, months on end. But the Northern Zen, Rinzai Zen, just emphasised the koan. And the koan is a kind of it's a riddle that can't be solved intellectually through the use of bivalent reason. But nevertheless, you can kind of see a resolution is kind of possible. And that resolution is usually some kind of explosion of the mind. The mind explodes. And a koan, for instance, is something like... I mean, a Zen master might say to a student, this is your koan, go away and ponder this for as long as it takes. You say something like, what is a mouse when it spins? You know, or show me your original face before you were born. Or imagine you're standing on the top of a 50-foot flagpole and you can't go forward and you can't go back and you can't stay the same. Now what? It's these kind of mind-defeating riddles. And the thing there is to snap the mind into silence, to shock the mind into silence by giving it an impossible task until everything kind of flips. And well, the mind blows, basically, with that. And it's obviously quite a different approach. And Mondo, the thing that we've talked about here, is the riddling, strange, apparently irrational or unreasonable conversation between the Zen master and the student. From the point of view of the Zen master is simply expressing himself, I think. You know, it's simply a matter of the free play of the uninhibited intelligence, the spontaneous intelligence of the master. For the student, it's this kind of significant thing that they endow a lot of significance into. And so from the point of view of the student, having the mondo with the master can be kind of a tense and frightening thing. Yeah. We've already seen one example, and the story of Uruk-hai and Bodhidharma is a mondo. It's a prototype mondo, I suppose, there. And here is another example. I really like this one. This is Joshua's Zen, Joshua's mondo. I'm not quite sure when Joshua was around it, but he's certainly a prominent Zen master, you know, one of the great Zen masters. And I shall read you his mondo. Joshua began the study of Zen when he was 16 and continued until he was 80, when he realised Zen. It took from the age of 80 until he was 120. A student once asked him, if I haven't anything in my mind, what shall I do? Joshua replied, throw it out. But I haven't anything, how can I throw it out? Continued the questioner. Well, said Joshua, then carry it out. It doesn't actually say there what happened to the student, but usually in these stories they say, well, the student was then instantly enlightened, he experienced Satori. And Satori, I suppose, is the enlightenment moment, you know. I called it the far side of chaos. Satori is the far side of chaos. It's a bit poetic.
Or he might have just gone to the pub.
He might have gone to the pub, yeah. But it's the way they chat. It's like the convention in those stories that the student gets it, you know. He either gets it or has to go away for another 20 years. And
struggle for
And struggle even more, you know, because the guy's just intensifying the existential crisis.
Yeah.
Because it's there to kind of crack. It's there to crack you up, really, yeah. For Sartori, I said it, is a sudden, sometimes rapturous enlightenment, which may produce permanent alteration in consciousness. An easefulness, which, however, is consistent with the ordinary, whilst having a noetic quality. Noetic means knowledge, you feel as though you know something. Though we may not sensibly able to express what it is that we know, it's a sense of knowing, but not quite sure that you can find the words. Because in all this, of course, there is a deep sense of the limits of words as well. Just as we have this sense of the absolute necessity of reason, we know that it has a limit even though we can't discern it. Same thing is true of language, of course, and of course language and reason have got this intimate connection anyway. I've actually, when I've talked about the methods here, I outlined one other method. I said, well, daily life is a method. And it is, you know, because on this Zen take, you know, Nirvana is samsara, straight from Nagarjuna, Nirvana is samsara. The enlightened state is the same as the ignorant state, as the worldly state. The world is the same ontological sphere as the transcendental world. Transcendence and immanence are the same. These opposites have been dissolved. Again, we have a non-biviolent logic. Opposites don't have to be absolutely stark and against each other. We're going beyond X and not X as the only possibilities. We have both X and not X. So, for that reason, everyday life, just living everyday life, can be a Zen technique or a Zen method, in as much as it has methods. And if you understand that, you realise that very often when there's a mondo between the Zen master and the student, that the master is pointing the student straight the way back to the ordinary, to the ordinary life. There's another mondo here. Somebody asked the Zen master, what is the Tao, meaning the ultimate reality, or what would enlightenment consciously be like? And the master said, the hedge at the bottom of the garden. You know, and it sounds paradoxical, and it is paradoxical, and it sounds crazy, and it is crazy, but at the same time, it ultimately has this deeper rationality. Unreason has this deeper rationality, just as rationality has its deeper unreason, and its lack of grounding, and it's always finding itself in areas of paradoxes of self-reference or infinite regresses, whereby we can't kind of find an end to the endless why. And the master is pointing that out just by bringing the student back to the ordinary, to everyday life, to living as a human being. And if there's a bit of awareness, the whole truth of Zen is there, if you want it to be. It's a question of allowing, I think. At the same time, there's not much one can do to force this stuff, for reasons I keep going and going on about. At the same time, one can allow it, because we are in the midst of it. Because we have a life. If you're alive and conscious, reasonably compos mentis, and reasonably happy with a degree of craziness, you simply need to allow. Uses. What's the use of all this? Why make such a fuss about all this? Well, the use of unreason is pretty well the same as the use of reason for an individual, ultimately. And that is, it enables one to live well. In other words, to live with ease in the midst of the chaos of life and the suffering of life, to live with ease. All of this is so that one may live with ease. And this is no small thing, is it? Really, I mean, all the philosophy, as we say, you know, has either been powered forward by Socrates' question, how shall we live well, Or the Buddha's question, how shall we live well by suffering less? Enormous human effort has been put into figuring this stuff out, or attempting to figure it out. It's extremely significant to us. Our existential crises are very real when we have them. Just ask that Hui Kai bloke. He got it so bad he lopped his arm off. So living well, living with ease, but also creativity. And the silence and the ease gives rise to spontaneous creativity in all kinds of areas. There's an insight here that if one wants to play music or do calligraphy or paint pictures or do martial arts, that if you're tense and if you're trying to calculate all the time and if you're furrowing your brow, it probably isn't going to work. You're not going to produce anything beautiful or elegant. That the beautiful and the elegant and the enlightening in creativity comes out of a spontaneous allowing. Just as one masters the art of meditation by allowing, one masters the art of improvised music by allowing, one masters the art of calligraphy by allowing. If you don't allow your spontaneous awareness and intelligence to play out in martial arts, you're dead. And this is why the samurai were so attracted to Zen, because it showed them how to be utterly spontaneous and not inhibited by trying to calculate what the next move will be, but by allowing the next move to happen absolutely in the instant. Without that, you die if you play around with very sharp swords. So that's the second use, creativity. And the Japanese aesthetic is absolutely full of this. Calligraphy, the tea ceremony, the ink paintings, the martial arts, the spontaneous poetry. Another use is that all of this provides fresh perspectives. If you're a philosopher or a thinker or a sociologist or a political analyst or anything like this, there's nothing more useful to you than to be able to entertain fresh perspectives, at least temporarily, so you can see how a problem looks from the other side, or from the left, or from the right, or from behind. You know, and the more with Nietzsche on this, you know, the more perspective you can get on an issue, the nearer your approach to objectivity is, the safer and more reliable your thoughts are and your conclusions are. Fresh perspectives for philosophers and thinkers, and just, which of course is everybody, people think. Fresh perspectives on your existential crises. So, it all sounds like a bit of craziness that's a geekish kind of corner of culture that geeky people like us are interested in. I'd want to put it to you that there's more hangs by it than that. Okay, so the uses of unreason are considerable. Zen Mondo, craziness, a certain willingness to entertain fresh perspectives are all grist to your mill, and they're all things which can help you to live well, and not only well, but really well. And with that, I think I'll stop.
Oh, well, I hope that was useful to everybody. There's lots of things to think about in there.
And not think about.
We can think about them with reason and unreason now, and enjoy them both.